Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
On the Progressive Radio Network, it's NBL on PRN.FM, this November 17th, 2015 edition, episode 64 of Nature Bats Last comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. Our thanks again to Afrizen for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Today's show features a conversation with Paul Fallon, and we'll be taking your calls from him and for us as well. You can call us toll-free at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. But before we kick off our discussion with Paul, Guy has a comment. Guy?
Thanks, Mike. I look forward to our conversation with Paul Fallon. First, though, I have a self-congratulatory comment and then a little rant to get the juices flowing. We crossed the Rubicon of 100,000 listens last night after only 63 episodes.
Woo! Yay, us!
Party on. Congratulations to everybody involved in Nature Bass Blast and the Progressive Radio Network. And, by the way, I didn't pad the stats. As much as I love the sound of my own voice, I've not listened to a single show in the archive.
Huh?
Yeah, I know. And now, a little ramp. Let's start with an audio clip. This was posted yesterday on YouTube, and we've extracted a few seconds out of the YouTube clip, and it has the title Genius Hour, Global Warming Q&A with an Expert.
And then a warmer age, this ice age, and then a warmer age. It just so happens that we were caught in between the transition to from an ice age to a warmer age. If we can overcome and adapt to this, the human race may go on, but if we tend to fall under this, then I guess that's it.
Okay. What can you do about it?
Well, all I can do now, since I'm only...
All right. That's from a 10-year-old girl in her fifth grade classroom. She understands what many adults do not understand. Climate change is poised to cause human extinction. Again, that's from a clip on YouTube called Genius Hour, Global Warming Q&A with an Expert. And in this case, a 10-year-old plays the expert in her fifth-grade classroom. Yeah, so she gets it. Adults are more inclined to use headlines such as this one, which I harvested from a mainstream outlet just a few days ago. Quote, global climate in context as the world approaches 1 degree C above pre-industrial for the first time. Even worse than this are the headlines concluding we're halfway to the danger level. Let's take these two issues one at a time. The hubris of civilized humans never ceases to amaze. It's not the first time the planet will be 1 degree Celsius above baseline. It's not even the first time in human history. It is the first time in the history of civilization, though, and I suppose history, technically, begins with civilization. So I'll grant the headline writers that one, reluctantly, because I'm in a generous mood. But halfway to the danger level? Tell that to the millions of people without water or food because of climate change. Tell that to the 5 million people who die every year as a result of climate change. Tell that to the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases, which concluded in October 1990 that 1 C above baseline was the absolute upper limit we could not cross. Since then, of course, we've triggered dozens of the kinds of self-reinforcing feedback loops we were being warned about by the United Nations in October of 1990. End of rant.
You're an alarmist.
So I've heard.
All right. Our guest today is Paul E. Fallon. He's an architect who designed healthcare facilities for 32 years After the 2010 Haiti earthquake, Paul got involved in building two projects in Grand Gove, Haiti, a small town 10 miles west of the earthquake's epicenter. The logistical and cultural challenges proved as great as the technical ones. In 2012, Paul divided his time between Haiti and the United States. The cultural dissonance of traveling between the wealthiest and the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere led him to write a book about his experience, Architecture by Moonlight, Rebuilding Haiti, Redrafting a Life. Although working in developing countries was satisfying, it is weighed down by the hierarchical relationships between those who have skills and resources and those who do not. Upon returning to the United States, Paul retired from the healthcare design field, decided to pursue a project that promotes communication with as little hierarchy as possible. In May this year, Paul left his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and began riding his bicycle to the 48 contiguous United States, or states, the lower 48. He asked people along the way, how will we live tomorrow? So far, he's traveled over 8,000 miles and visited multiple states, over 25, I imagine, at this point, and asked hundreds of people his question. He writes about his travels and the responses he receives at www.howwillwelivetomorrow.com. Paul joins us this afternoon from Arizona. Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network, Paul Fallon.
Thank you very much. Nice to speak with you.
I was in Seattle this past August, and I was waiting for a ride from the airport when I picked up a local newspaper and read about your bike ride, and it caught my attention since that's really what our show is about, how we will live tomorrow, how will we live tomorrow. It's really kind of what we address almost on every single episode. And we talk a great deal about hierarchy and hierarchical systems and the damage they inflict. And I was wondering if you could talk about your experiences with hierarchy and your subsequent response to it, if you would.
Well, as you said in your introductory comments, part of the reason that I embarked on this project is to try to be involved in something with as little hierarchy as possible. During my career, which was in the American healthcare system, of course, I dealt with a lot of hierarchy. My specialty was working with medical professionals trying to determine the best way to organize their space for present and future technologies and procedures. And our medical system is very hierarchical in terms of level of professional expertise and ranking, experience, money made, that type of stuff. So when I got involved in Haiti, there was hierarchy of a very different order that I found, which was that no matter what my personal objectives might be about trying to understand as best possible what it was that the folks in the communities that we were working in would best meet and want their needs, there was always a hierarchical shift. I was always the white guy who came from far away, who had money and resources and technology, and the local people in Haiti were always the people who were the local people in Haiti. And finally, my experience there really changed my understanding of the nature of philanthropy. It changed my understanding of the nature of giving and of aid, in that I feel like we don't spend near enough time understanding and investigating what the motives are of the people who are quote-unquote giving, including my own motives, which I wound up spending a lot of time investigating and analyzing during my time and my commitment there. So when I came back to the States, and a lot of people said to me, oh, you know, are you going to keep going to Haiti? Or other people would say to me, oh, are you going to go to where there was a tsunami and where the next natural disaster was? I was like, no, I'm actually not going to do that. And I came up with this idea of riding around the country on a bicycle, which puts me automatically sort of at a different perspective than most people, since most people are in cars, and asking a question that is simply asked face-to-face, usually across a table, with someone. So the idea is that I am not an expert. I don't have the answer. I just bring the question. And I initiate conversation that doesn't really have hierarchy. My objective is to talk to as wide a range of people as is possible. And I do think traveling on a bicycle has helped me in that regard. All kinds of people have spoken to me. And I've talked to permaculture farmers and organic farmers, and I have talked to executives at McDonald's Corporation. I have talked to police officers. I have talked to oil and gas people who were involved in fracking. And I have been talking to people who do desalinization work, and I've also talked to activists who are working to prevent such activities. So it's been a great experience so far. To update you, I am now actually in Phoenix, Arizona. I just passed my 10,000-mile mark and my six-month mark of travel. So I'm approximately halfway through my journey, and so far it's just been awesome.
Halfway? Holy cow. I mean, you've been on your bike. You talked about the bike. Do you think the bike? My impression is that the bike sets people at ease a little bit to open up. Is that kind of the case?
Yeah, I just had an intuition that doing this trip on a bike was going to somehow be different, and I have to say I completely underestimated it. The only reason my bike works, my trip works, is because I am on a bicycle. I am not a journalist. I do not have reporter credentials, although I have written a blog for a long time and I have one, you know, very underread book under my belt. I really don't have the kind of things that would open the doors to talking to different people in different places. But when I go into a town, I usually just 3 to 5 days out in advance, I sort of think, well, what's going on in this town that's noteworthy? What have I heard about this town? What's going on in this town that might somehow implicate or affect what we're doing tomorrow? I send out email queries to people, usually someone I don't know at all, and I am amazed at how many people will spend an hour or 2 hours and sit down and talk to me.
Wow.
And if I ask them, like, well, why did you decide to spend time with me? The answer is always because I'm on a bike. I mean, it's the fact that I'm on a bicycle that makes me somehow available to people.
Yeah.
So you're more approachable because you're sort of on the same scale, I guess. You're on a bike. You're not in a big lumbering 2-ton vehicle.
Yeah, but even when I'm not on the same scale, I mean, I had an interview with CR England Trucking Company in Salt Lake City. They're not necessarily a company that, you know, going to resonate with somebody on a bicycle. I met with the director of the Wyoming Cattle Growers Association. I learned all about the beef industry. You know, these are not kindred spirits to sort of the bike culture, and yet people will talk to me. I think somebody on a bicycle is really not threatening.
Yeah, this guy isn't going to run me over.
There's that. I mean,
no. Right. In any altercation, I'm going to lose. I am fully aware of that.
I mean, just from an athletic standpoint, what was your preparation for this? You've ridden 10,000 miles.
That's a long way.
I mean, how much time on a bike prior to this were you?
Well, the funny thing is, I did no preparation, and I tell people that all the time. This is a long distance thing. It's not like sprinting. It's not like being in a race. Mm-hmm. You start it, and within a couple of weeks, you get a little better at it, but it's not really a huge thing. I was always a person who rode my bike around my community. I rode about 100 miles a week. I rode to work. I rode to the grocery store. You know, I live in a place where traffic is terrible and parking is difficult. So riding a bike makes a lot of sense when the weather permits it. I had done one previous long-distance ride. My family lives in the Denver area, and I go out there every year, and we do a part of our reunion is to do a fundraising ride to the local children's hospital there. And in 2011, I took the summer off, and I rode from Denver back to Boston. So I had one 3,000-mile ride under my belt.
Wow.
4 years ago. And otherwise, I have to tell you, I did no actual training in advance of this. You know, I am a 60-year-old man. I'm in relatively good shape for my age, but I am 60 years old. I average about 50 miles a day. and some days are harder than others. They vary in distance from, sometimes I do no miles, and sometimes I do, my longest day has been 150. But my goal is to average 50, and I'm on track with that.
Well, that 50 miles is 50 miles more every day than I've ridden in the last, 40 years, you know, since I was 15. So I could do this. What you're saying is, come on out. I can join you.
Yeah. I'm 50. Yeah. Yeah, it's so different than, you know, running a marathon or running a race, or there's no special requirements. You know, everybody has to find their own thing, and some people don't like to ride bicycles, but if you like to ride your bicycle, you just are not in a rush, because I don't go fast. In fact, I go super slow. First of all, I am mostly going to places I will never be again. So I always stop and take pictures and talk to people. Secondly, I'm on a tour, and touring bikes are fundamentally different than most bicycles. My bicycle is actually quite heavy. It's made of steel frame construction, got a big heavy rack to carry my possessions on it, and my whole assembly weighs about 72 pounds. That's my bike and all my stuff. That's maybe light compared to a lot of other people who are touring, but that's a lot to be lugging around and pedaling with you. So I average somewhere between 8 and 10 miles an hour, and that's a function of, you know, whether the wind is my friend that day and how much uphill and downhill I have. So, you know, compared to what we hear about bicycle racing, it's nothing. I don't go fast.
Right, right. So I think that the willingness of people to talk to you at length, you know, for extended periods of time, probably is telling us something about our need for intimacy, our need for serious conversation, our inability to have those conversations in most of our lives. Can you comment a little bit about that?
I do think it's interesting that you mention it. Certainly one of the themes that comes out of the responses that I get. At this point in time, I probably have had over 1,000 people answer my question. And every response that I get, I put on my website. But when I sit down and have an interview with somebody, or I stay with someone overnight and, you know, we talk at length, then I will write what I refer to as a profile about them. And I talk about their background, I have some photos, or talk about their business if it's a company. And in general, there are certain, what would you say? There are certain categories or certain themes that come out of our conversations. And one of the themes is certainly about how technology has affected communication and our sense of community. And it's a double-edged sword. There are people who think it's great, and there are people who think it's problematic. But in general, anyone that's sitting down and taking that amount of time with me is somebody who really values the fact that face-to-face communication has there's a fuller range of communication going on when you are sitting talking to someone and looking at them in the same time in the same place. You know, there are those famous studies that were done about how much of our communication is based on the words that we say and how much is based on our reflection and how much is based on our body language. And when we are using any other form of communication beyond face-to-face real time, we are only getting a piece of all of the things that totally add up to be complete communication. And so when I have the opportunity to sit and talk to someone at length, I think people really value the fact that it's really 100% of all of our communication skills are all functioning. And it's pretty much what I do at night. It is amazing that on my trip, I stay with someone who invites me into their home almost every night. Mm-hmm. When I started, I thought I would mostly be staying in motels. I camp occasionally. I'm not a big camper. But the truth is, as more people hear about my journey and hear about what's going on, more and more people invite me to stay with them when I am traveling. And so these are people who are clearly looking for the opportunity to sit down and have a conversation, because they make me dinner, they give me a place to stay, they let me take a shower, they usually give me breakfast in the morning, some even send me off with a packed lunch.
When and where can I join?
Excuse me?
This sounds great.
Need to get our
I have to say that the trip has turned out to be so inexpensive, which wasn't even part of the plan. But I actually think I spend less money riding around the world on my bicycle than I did when I was home. And that was never part of the plan, but I've learned that I call it question soup. I refer to that folk tale of stone soup where the itinerant guy goes from town to town and he has a stone in his pocket. He tells people he wants to make soup out of a stone, and then he starts to cajole them to add carrots and other related things, and all of a sudden they have this really rich, good soup. I say that what I do is question soup. I come around with a question, and people contribute all these things, and we have this really wonderful conversation, this rich experience, and what I bring to the table is the question. What I bring to the table is the opportunity to have a really connected conversation with somebody.
So you're Socrates on a bicycle.
I don't equip myself to Socrates. More just a folktale.
You know what happened to him, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I have to be careful on my bicycle, too. I always say everyone loves people on bicycles except when the bicycle is actually on the road.
That's actually true. Yes. My parents are cyclists, and they can account for that. Let's talk about some of your more memorable, I guess, answers or encounters, if you could share some moments and conversations you had or pieces of conversation.
Yeah, actually, I can. I'll share one that happened on my very first night when I was in Wisconsin. And it was great because I was staying with this guy who had been a Navy SEAL. He was engaged, and his fiance had three teenage sons, and we were staying in their house, and it was kind of chaotic and a lot of fun. And he turned out to be a home brew guy, so he had amazing beer, and I thought that was great because it was my first night in Wisconsin. And he says to me, I only asked my question once. You know, I'm not pushing. It doesn't matter. People don't have to answer, but we're having a conversation. At one point I asked, well, you know, what are your thoughts about how will we live tomorrow? And he says, you know, I don't like your question. He says, it's too open-ended. It's too broad. He says, I don't think it has enough focus. That's fine. We go on and we have conversations. So I get up the next morning, and he's making me some oatmeal before I ship out. And he says to me, well, I've been thinking about your question. Well, that's exactly the point, okay? I mean, the point of the question is certainly not that there's a right response or a wrong response. The point is simply thinking about the question. And I said, okay, well, yeah, what are you thinking about? And then this guy, who's like, he's in his 40s, he's definitely a big kind of bear, military kind of guy, he says to me, we are going to live tomorrow in the memory of those who love us.
Oh.
And that was just really an incredible answer for me. It was probably one of the most poetic answers anyone had given. It was really well thought through, and really interesting and different perspective.
So you could have
excuse me? So I found that to be, I'm missing the connection.
Huh. Yeah, sorry. So you could have quit right then and saved yourself 10,000 miles. You know,
right. I could have, but I didn't. I have to say that I believe that every day I get a slightly different take on the question. Mm. And it actually took a long time to develop the question. The question was probably modified and caressed for over a year. I brainstormed it with different people. I tested it for a month before I left by asking it to people around Boston. And it's like all things that are really work well. It sounds like such a simple question, but in fact, each of the words were pretty carefully thought through.
Yeah.
It is conscientiously, it's a how question, because I want it to be rooted in the world that we're in. And that's also why it has the word tomorrow in it as opposed to the future. I don't ask people how are we going to live in the future, because That that makes it more of a fantasy question. You know, tomorrow is always what immediately follows from today. And whether somebody is talking about tomorrow as 24 hours from now or tomorrow as 10,000 years from now, it's still grounded in the fact that tomorrow has to be an extension of today. It has to be related to today. It can't be completely unrelated. For me, the most important question in the question is the word we. And, you know, I always tell people I crafted this question for America. You know, we is a really hard word in the United States. It's not really part of our identity and part of the way we think of ourselves. We are the nation of individuals. And about 25% of the people who answer my question, the very first word that they say out of their mouth is the word I. And I've just come to understand that. Yeah. Yeah. So I'll say, how will we live tomorrow? And people will say, I will, blah, blah, blah. Huh. And that always amazes me, you know. But it's we is a really, really hard concept for Americans. You know, it's just a really difficult one.
Yeah, you know, no doubt. We even find that on our own show that we're constantly, the topics we talk about are constantly butting up against the individualism that we are brought up in. And specifically, we run into that amongst guys that look like us, it's generally white men. They like to give a lot of I answers, we've noticed. And that's just kind of, you know, that's just kind of the way it goes. It doesn't surprise me that it's 25%. In fact, I thought it might have been even a little higher. On our show, we talk a lot about things that are pretty dark about tomorrow, because we talk about climate change. We talk about abrupt climate change, which we believe will eventually lead to the extinction of our species. So that being said, what do you think is the prevailing attitude out there on the road? Are you finding people are generally positive about how we will live tomorrow, or is it indifferent? What is it out there that you've seen? Is it all over the map?
Yeah. It's not all over the map. It's, let's see. I would say climate change is the thing probably that most people will resonate with as a sort of theme. I think that the responses run pretty 50-50, positive or negative. It's amazing. Now, there are some consistencies. Basically, the more comfortable someone is with technology, whether you're well-educated, whether you're young, whether you have good access to it, whether you feel in control of it, people who have higher connections with technology generally give me much more positive responses to the question than people who don't have access to technology or have fear of technology. I'd say that's probably one of the strongest themes that I see. I talk to a lot of faith-based groups. I have consciously gone to visit a number of immigrant groups throughout the United States and people of a broad range of religious backgrounds. And most people who come from a faith-based perspective have a personally positive view of what's going to happen tomorrow because they believe in salvation and redemption, all this related stuff. So even though they may think that we are going to go to extinction, that's sort of irrelevant from their perspective. That may not be very comforting, but that's, you know, they're like, well, the world is going to disappear, but it's okay. And people who are of a very staunch fundamentalist Christian perspective they definitely take the view that some of the things that we are doing, which appear to be hastening the demise of humans on this planet, are actually sort of good from a religious perspective because they are hastening the second coming, and from their perspective, they would like to be here when that happens. That's if you are of a particular faith-based persuasion, that can be really positive to people who don't follow that creed, it's kind of scary.
Yeah, we need to start marketing towards the evangelicals.
Yeah, marketing. We need to get into marketing, Bill Hicks style.
Yeah. But
this is Nature Bites Last on the Progressive Radio Network. We're conversing today with Paul Fallon. You can find out more about his work at howwillwelivetomorrow.com. Paul, I saw a lot of questions on that website that implied more, bigger, and better in the future, as if the Jetsons and their flying cars were right around the corner. Can you comment on that?
There are people who, having bought into technology as the way, the sort of primary driver of our life, acknowledge the fact that technology has created a lot of problems, but believe that technology is also then going to be the salvation of those problems. So it's really interesting to see how that happens. There, a theme that has come up pretty often is a lot of people talk about the fact that over the past 10 years or so, technology has created such an incredible transformation in the way we communicate. Smartphones, Skyping, you know, you name it, the whole way of communicating has radically changed over the last 10 years to last generation. And a lot of people anticipate that that level of transformation is going to happen over the next period of time with regards to transportation. And it's interesting because some people think that's really positive because they think transportation is going to get way more energy efficient and then we're going to find ways to do transportation that are independent of fossil fuels and all of that related stuff. And other people seem to be not interested or worried about fossil fuels, and they're just, I literally had someone talk about the fact that everybody was going to have their own plane. I was like, okay, I mean, this is a pretty reasonable, responsible adult who was using it too. It wasn't like a 12-year-old kid. But the truth is, I do think there's a lot of credence to the idea that our transportation systems are going to change. The fact of automated driving, even within the context of vehicles as we have them now, the reality of automated driving is going to be a total economic disruptor. About 6% of all the jobs in the United States are now related to driving trucks and moving stuff around. And 10 years from now, those jobs are not really even going to be needed. And in fact, we're going to find that we're driving safer and there's less accidents and stuff like that when humans are no longer driving. Most of those jobs are jobs that males have. In general, it's interesting to me that most of the jobs that are being replaced by automation are traditionally male jobs, traditionally female jobs, which have more to do with communication and human interactions, are less easy to replace than traditional male jobs. And so I think there's a lot of credence in the fact that transportation changes are going to be huge. But there's still this kind of bifurcated notion that some people think it's all going to be great, and then some people think, well, those changes are all going to be terrible. Some people think those changes are going to liberate us from fossil fuels and the associated global warming and stuff like that, and other people think it's just going to exacerbate the problem and make it worse. Right. So I don't think that – I'm not sure I answered your question, but that's the kind of range of responses that I get.
Do you think people – I mean, is your sense that people out there – and again, I know this ranges, but you can kind of get an underlying or an overall sense of things. Are people happy?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Yeah, people are really happy in general. And people are understandably distrustful of media and don't understand why the media is so focused on so many things that are so bad. I think people are incredibly good. I mean, I've literally been a vulnerable being out on the road for 6 months, and I have had nothing but positive experiences. I have had nothing but people who welcome me into their homes. I've had nothing people answer my question. It's just kind of incredible to me. I do think people are happy. People are happy in their communities, and they feel really good about their communities. And they feel – and one of the more interesting themes of what comes out is – how do people define community, okay? And that is really a key to where their comfort level is. So I had two experiences 3 days apart that were really striking to me. I was in Missoula, Montana, staying with a woman named Ethel McDonald. She's 76 years old. She's a total firebrand. She's an absolutely wonderful person. She doesn't drive a car anymore. She rides her bike around, and she's totally into a whole range of sort of personal sustainable activities. And I stayed with her one evening, and when I got there, she said, well, I have to go out tonight. And we had dinner and stuff like that. And then I stayed up so we could talk when she got home. We started talking around 11 o'clock or so, and it was midnight, and this woman was still going strong. And she reaches out in her chair, and she spreads her arm wide, and she says to me, the community I care about are the 7 billion people on this planet. Okay? So that was her definition of community.
Right.
3 days later, I was staying in Sandpoint, Idaho, and I was staying with a Mormon family. It was a Sunday, so it was family day for the Mormons. I was there with a husband, a wife, and 4 children. And they had spent the whole day doing their family activities, no TV, no video games, none of that stuff like that. And we're having dinner, and we're talking about community. And the wife says, we have 3 acres, we have cows, we have some chickens, we have a garden. She said, when disaster strikes, the community I care about are myself, my husband, and my 4 children.
Mm.
So I felt like, well, there's like the full range over a period of 3 days that I had someone who was defining community as absolutely every single human being on the face of the earth, and someone who was so clear and articulate about saying, no, this is it. And we're protecting ourselves so that when bad things happen, we 6 can survive. In general, I have a hard time relating to that second approach because I think it's unrealistic. But secondly, I feel like it's people who take that approach are kind of selling themselves and their neighbors and the rest of us short, that we all have a lot to gain by trying to accept the widest possible community. But I also understand it's the nature of human beings, that not everyone can be like Ethel McDonald. When I was in western North Dakota only has 750,000 people, and I just loved North Dakota. It was like my favorite so far of all the states I've traveled, in my favorite. And I was talking to someone living in a little town in western North Dakota, and they were talking about community. And I said, well, how big is your community? I said, is North Dakota your community? And they looked at me, and it was sort of a joke, but they said, well, everything except Fargo. So now you have to realize Fargo's on the eastern edge of the state, and it's the largest city. It has all 60,000 people. But, you know, for somebody who was, like, in a rural community, Fargo was, you know, it was a little bit of a joke, but not really a joke. You know, Fargo was really, they couldn't embrace what went on there because they had, you know, big city problems in Fargo. So the range of how people describe community to me is a really interesting aspect of my project and the responses that I get. And one of the things I think, now, you know, I'm only halfway through and I'm trying not to make assertions that I want to continue to explore for the next half of the country. But I do have this sense that that's one of the things that's going to help us to a better place, is to help people feel better about community in a wider sense. I mean, it's kind of a joke, but it happens often that I will be someplace and someone will say, oh, well, the people in Fergus Falls are the nicest people in the world, but when you go to St. Cloud, you're going to have to be careful. And then I'll go to St. Cloud, and they'll say, the people in St. Cloud are the nicest people in the world, but when you go to St. Joe's, you better be careful. And I mean, it is, literally, this happens town after town. And I'm like, really? But, you know, that's a very, very kind of tribal thing. So that's a long answer to your question of, are people happy? But I think, yeah, people are happy, and they're happy in their community.
I think it's pretty amazing, this us-them mentality. That seems to infect us all.
Well, I think that it served an evolutionary purpose for hundreds of thousands of years, but it's actually not serving us very well in a global economy.
Yeah, and same with having a bunch of babies to satisfy your own version of fitness.
Right.
There's a bunch of evolutionary characteristics that aren't serving us very well anymore.
Right.
So what's your sense out there on the road, can we make a shift from our hierarchical thinking into something else? And if so, what would that something else be?
Oh, that's a really good question.
I'm sorry, we can go on to another one if you
want. No, I like
that's what
it.
We do, Paul. We write really good questions.
Right,
like you.
Right. You know, hierarchical thinking has served us well for a long time. You know, us versus them. This is what I know, when I talk to people who are in very specialized thing, I realize that the nature of our society, with higher and higher levels of specialization, becomes more and more levels of expertise, and yet people are missing an opportunity for creative outlet. And I suppose, back to your question of are people happy, this would probably be my caveat. I think people are really looking for a way to express themselves creatively. And if I've learned one thing, it's that the consumer society does not address a person's creative needs. More and more people want to make things. More and more people want to be involved in formulating things. So the interesting thing that I see, and maybe this will get to the answer about the hierarchy, is like in San Francisco, I spent a bunch of time talking to people in the maker movement. And I went to visit the Crucible, which is this huge warehouse facility that's basically like a gym for craftsmen. You can join, you have an annual membership or monthly membership, and they have 18 different shops there. They have 4 different kinds of welding shops. They have ceramic shops. They have, they have a foundry. They have this woodworking, glass making. They have all these great things. And what's interesting when you go to Crucible is that you see people in the high-tech industry who are making prototypes of, you know, apps and other related pieces of stuff. And then you see people who are doing more artistic stuff. There are people who are, they're just making things. They're, you know, that we've lost the ability to make something in our hands as our society has become more differentiated and more specialized. And I think one of the things I see as a potential positive of technology is how it may eventually get to the point that it can bring us back there. And that's kind of what the maker movement is all about. I talked to a woman in Colorado who said, you know, my mother says I'm not anything like her. I am like my grandmother because I make my own food and I grow my own vegetables and I dye my own yarn and I like to knit and crochet. Because this woman was involved in handcrafts and creating things as an adjunct to her high-tech job. You know, it was like it's like going out and buying stuff is not, well, we all know this intellectually, but we're sold this all the time with advertising. Buying things is not satisfying. Making things is satisfying. And so can we find, is there a way that we address working towards something that's non-hierarchical where our technology can actually, instead of making us more and more specialized and more differentiated, can our technology actually free us to become more creative and to make our own things? A lot of people talk about the quote-unquote maker movement and the opportunity for technology to bring us back to an age of craftsmanship.
Right. Which is desperately needed, in my opinion, as well. Well, I mean, we have one question for you, and it's your own question. How will we live tomorrow, Paul?
Well, I don't ask the question. I do not answer the question because I still have 10,000 more miles to go to ask the question. However, okay. What I will tell you, I will tell you why I asked that question, which I think is revealing in its own way. I am a 60-year-old person. When my father was my age, he was still working full-time, and he died within 10 years of now. When my grandfather was my age, he had debilitating cancer and was dead within 2 years of my age. So So when I got to be 58 years old and realized that I no longer needed to work for monetary reasons, I had already raised my children. It was like, okay, this is a different way of thinking about life. This is like, I could die tomorrow. I could live for 40 more years. I mean, the world is, you know, our lifespans are changing dramatically, especially among people like myself who are very fortunate in having had good health and good health care and good diet and all of those things. Now, unfortunately, not everyone in this country has access to all that, but for those of us who do, these are amazing times. So I was thinking about the fact that life among people in the quote-unquote middle age is really going to change. And most of us, I'm an architect by profession, and most of us are not living in ways that are particularly good, right? Many of us have two big houses that are empty of kids. And we are looking for our community. We're looking for opportunities so that as we age, we can age gracefully and we can be supportive of each other. But our physical environment is not conducive to that at all, because we've bought into this idea that everybody has their own house and their own everything. And that's been great from a consumer perspective, but it is a nightmare in terms of living in community and being social and stuff. So my initial idea was, I want to go out and explore people throughout the country who are living middle-aged in a different way. And that seemed like an okay idea. And several people said, you know, you ought to just go have the experience, because that seems awfully restrictive. And so my initial query was more about how will middle-aged people live tomorrow in a very physical way, in sort of an architectural spatial way. And then my question grew into the much broader question, which I ask now, which is, how will we live tomorrow? And as my question grew to this broader perspective, so did my understanding of why I wanted to go on this journey. So I feel like the United States is at this key juncture where the things that made us such an amazing, innovative, and different place to be on this world, which is the fact that we have so much individual initiative, and we have a land of amazing resources that was basically limitless in its capability, that those things, which made the first 200-plus years of our existence so incredible, are now becoming our biggest detriments. They're our biggest obstacles to getting along with others and playing well in the global sandbox. And that's really why I thought, that's why I want to ask this question. And that's why I want to ask this question in the United States. Because how will we live tomorrow is not something that we can be as deterministic about as we have been in the past. And I think that we as a country have to evolve and become much better about coordinating and looking to others and learning from others than we are now. That goes back to some of my initial understanding about my time in Haiti and why I wrote a book about my time in Haiti, is that when I was spending time in Haiti, I always realized, oh my gosh, we have so much to offer people in Haiti, but we also have so much to learn from people in Haiti. There's no one in Haiti who thinks they can make it on their own. I mean, that would just be like a ludicrous perspective. And yet, making it on our own is not only something we think in America we can do, it's highly valued as a positive thing. And ultimately, it is not a positive thing. Ultimately, we have to figure out how we find a balance between individual expression, individual initiative, individual opportunity, and collectively realizing that we are all in this together. And doesn't matter what our politics are, we are all in this together. And we have to figure out a way to get by together. So that's ultimately why I decided to ask this question at this time in our country, because I think we are at a really big transition to understand how the core values and the core essence of what it means to be an American comes up against the reality of what it means to be a good global citizen.
Well, thank you, Paul. That was a great answer, a great interview, and we wish nothing but safe travels and more fantastic experiences on your journey and you're passing through Gila, New Mexico, look us up.
Okay, I'd like that.
All right.
Thanks, Paul.
You've been listening to Paul Fallon, architect who is on his bicycle since May, traveling through the lower 48, asking the question, how will we live tomorrow? And you can find more of his work at howwillwelivetomorrow.com. All right, Guy, what do you got?
Pretty extensive climate change update this week. This month's issue of the journal Geology includes a paper that suggests ancient climates on Earth may have been more sensitive to a doubling of atmospheric carbon dioxide than is currently assumed, although we've not yet doubled atmospheric carbon dioxide above the slightly less than 280 parts per million experienced before the Industrial Revolution. The CO2 equivalent, when adding only atmospheric methane, is about 2.5 times greater than that figure of 280 parts per million. Whoopsie. Professor Jim Salinger, New Zealand's leading climate change scientist, last week confirmed we are in the midst of runaway climate change. This guy is no slouch, by the way. He was the lead author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's fourth assessment. That's the one that garnered a Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. He spent almost 30 years with the New Zealand Meteorological Society and the National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research. He's currently based at the University of Auckland's School of Environment. Thanks to our Kiwi friend Kevin Hester for extracting this statement from the professor at a public meeting. A study published in the November 9, 2015 edition of Nature Geoscience shows that lakes in the northern hemisphere will probably release much more carbon dioxide due to global climate changes than expected. The investigation, based on data from more than 5,000 Swedish lakes, demonstrates that carbon dioxide emissions from the world's lakes, watercourses, and reservoirs are equivalent to almost a quarter of all the carbon dioxide produced by burning fossil fuels. That's a big number. I've added this information to feedback number 28. A paper published in the November 10, 2015 online issue of Scientific Reports provides yet another example of an interaction between formation of sea ice and methane release. I'll quote from the first few lines of the abstract. Arctic amplification of global warming has led to increased summer sea ice retreat, which influences gas exchange between the Arctic Ocean and the atmosphere where sea ice previously acted as a physical barrier. Indeed, recently observed enhanced atmospheric methane concentrations in Arctic regions with fractional sea ice cover point to unexpected feedbacks in cycling of methane. Unexpected, I'll point out, only by the scientific community, which remains conservative in its approach, findings, and conclusions. A paper in the November 10, 2015 issue of Nature Communications reports that the pace of past episodes of climate change is likely to have been underestimated. The abstract concludes, quote, a compilation of 194 published oceanic and continental temperature changes spanning the Ordovician period, 476 million years ago, to the present provides a holistic picture of the attainable magnitude and rate of both warming and cooling episodes through Earth history across a range of measurement time spans. We demonstrate that magnitudes and rates of geological temperature changes in this compilation exhibit power law scaling with time span. Consequently, the true attainable pace of ancient climate change may be commonly underestimated, compromising our understanding of the relative pace and severity of both ancient and recent climate change, end quote. In this case, the title of the paper really tells the story. The title is Maximum Rates of Climate Change Are Systematically Underestimated in the Geological Record. Deniers of abrupt climate change are running out of arguments. We are in the midst of abrupt climate change. Today's ongoing event has ample precedence, as reported in this last paper. There's more, too, on the topic of abrupt climate change, and it comes from the same issue of the same journal. Another study published in the November 10th, 2015 issue of Nature Communications presents, quote, geomorphological data that reveal the existence of a large buried paleo-drainage network on the Mauritanian coast, end quote. I'll quote from the associated article in The Guardian, which is a bit more user-friendly, and it includes these lines. A vast river network that once carried water for hundreds of miles across western Sahara has been discovered under the parched sands of Mauritania. Water may last have coursed through the channels 5,000 years ago. End quote. The Sahara is currently among the driest places on Earth, The Guardian goes on to quote Russell Wynn at the National Oceanography Center in Southampton, England, who was not involved in this study. Quote, people sometimes can't get their head around climate change and how quickly it happens. And by people, I assume Wynn is talking about the vast majority of contemporary climate scientists when he says, quote, people can't get their head around climate change and how quickly it happens. This story reminds me of Derek Jensen, and especially one of his most descriptive lines about civilization. Forests precede us, and deserts dog our heels.
Word.
On last week's show, we talked about Greenland and its rapidly melting ice. We pointed out that, like the West Antarctic ice shelf, Greenland harbors about 20 feet of sea level rise. When it goes, and there's no stopping it at this point, Boston's Back Bay will become Boston's Front Water Park, and you'll need scuba gear to see the Statue of Liberty, Ocean Drive in Miami, Harvard University, and the baseball field that the Giants play in San Francisco. The good news is that there will be an abundance of scuba gear. The bad news is that there will be no humans around to use it. Yeah, I know. It's a tragedy. From the November 12, 2015 online issue of Science comes a paper titled Fast Retreat of the Caria Estrom, Northeast Greenland. The abstract reads, quote, after 8 years of decay of its ice shelf, the Caria Estrom, a major glacier of northeast Greenland that holds a 0.5-meter sea level rise equivalent, entered a phase of accelerated retreat in fall 2012. The acceleration rate of its ice velocity tripled, melting of its residual ice shelf and thinning of its grounded portion doubled, and calving is now occurring at its grounding line. Warmer air and ocean temperatures have caused the glacier to detach from a stabilizing sill and retreat rapidly along a downward-sloping marine-based bed. Its equal ice volume neighbor, which has a name completely unpronounceable to me, is also melting rapidly. I came across this latter story by way of an article in last week's Washington Post by Chris Mooney. He's been cranking out some great stories about abrupt climate change within the last few weeks. You might want to catch up with his before he loses his job. Today's final update comes from Richard Toll, a professor of economics at Suffolk University in England. His work is commonly quoted by climate change deniers and skeptics. On the BBC Radio 4 series Changing Climate, which aired on November 16, 2015, Toll concluded that more pronounced global warming is probably a net negative. He further predicted the downsides of warming will outweigh the advantages with a global warming of 1.1C, and we're already there. These are quite amazing admissions from a self-proclaimed skeptic of anthropogenic climate change.
Thank you, Guy. That about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bad Blast, and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well as Nature Bad Blast on PRN.FM. And feel free to post questions you'd like to address on the show, and continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll be interviewing Matt Devlin in anticipation of him hosting Guy at the Art Basel in Miami Beach, Florida, in the first week of December. If you missed the show, make sure to find us at the archive at PRN.FM and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our host, Paul Fallon, and to Appleton for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.